From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA.
Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping. With folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working.
It seems like everyone now is talking about women in power and politics. We get to hear from one woman who has made it all the way to the top. A revealing conversation with Michelle Bachelet, the first woman president of Chile.
It's difficult for them to understand that a woman can make tough decisions. I would say that was more at the beginning. Now everybody's used to it. I mean, it's a matter of time.
Also, change has come to Bolivia with that country's first indigenous president, Evo Morales.
Estamos con la raza, yo. Andamos con la raza, yo. Estamos con la raza, yo. 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 Yo.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Joining us to discuss the news affecting the Latino community this week is Ray Suarez, senior correspondent for the News Hour on PBS. Hey, Ray, how are you?
Hi, Maria. How are you?
Good, good. So let's talk about immigration and presidential politics. It hasn't been in the headlines, but John McCain has this ad in Spanish where essentially he talks about poison pills. In Spanish, they say píldoras de veneno. And he's saying that it was the Democrats that have that are using these poison pills to kill the immigration reform. Very controversial ad. What's your take on this?
Well, it's interesting. He doesn't mention in the ad that the McCain-Kennedy legislation, when it came to the floor, was almost unanimously supported by Democrats in the Senate, including Barack Obama, and almost universally opposed by his own Republican Party. I don't know of any specific legislation that Barack Obama either introduced or supported that would have helped sink the bill. But interestingly, John McCain also does not mention his own evolution over time when it comes to a bill, in fact, that carries his name, McCain-Kennedy. He says that he wouldn't vote for it today if it came to the Senate floor once again. And he now says that his basic immigration stance, if you want to sum it up in three words, is border security first.
All right, Ray, what about the new ad from the Barack Obama campaign releasing a new Spanish language ad? I haven't seen it. You've seen it. What's it about?
Well, it's a pretty tough ad. It's called Two Faces, Dos Caras, and it highlights the association between Senator John McCain and President Bush over the years. It talks about rising gas prices. It talks about rising unemployment. It talks about the economic difficulties of recent months and strongly associates John McCain with the Bush administration and the current economic record, and chooses its images carefully to show Bush in a less than flattering light and to show McCain in a less than flattering light as well.
Interestingly, Ray, I was just with Governor Bill Richardson in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he's talking about how the Latino community will be the vote that carries in Colorado, Nevada, and New Mexico. He says this is the new West and that, in fact, what he wants is more from the Obama campaign. It seemed like he was a little bit frustrated, almost saying, we need more of you here so that these Latino voters can see you, touch you, become convinced that you are their candidate. And it seems like Barack Obama has been there, I think, 4 times and is going to be there, but it seems like they want more of him.
Absolutely. I've spoken to several Latino elected officials from the West, and they've expressed the opinion that the Latino vote is going to come out heavily for Senator Obama, sort of refuting some of the speculation from the primary season that Hillary voters would not come over to the Illinois senator. But to a man and to a woman, they said he's got to be here more. He can do even better if he comes here more often, makes ad buys, and doesn't rest on the early poll numbers that now, with about 7 weeks to go, show Barack Obama leading McCain among Latino voters about 2-1.
Okay, and finally, Ray, this is a story that caught my attention. I immediately ripped it out, and I started wondering why more people are not talking about this story, which has to do with Latinos in the media. Carlos Slim Elú, the telecommunications billionaire, he bought a 6.4% stake in the New York Times company. He has a history of buying shares in American companies, but now he's turned to media Ray, what do you think of this?
Carlos Slim has been looking for multimedia properties in the United States, not to buy outright, but in which to own a stake. He has a history of buying shares in companies that are depressed in value, and then, when the time is right, turning around and selling them at a tidy profit. But Carlos Slim is also someone who has wanted to have influence and a voice in the United States. And when you buy a chunk of one of the most important media companies in America, and of course you have to make your intentions known with the Securities and Exchange Commission, you can't do it secretly, you do have to wonder why. It could be just a straight-up business play, or it could be something more, that Carlos Slim, who has occasionally had problems in the American media, may want to, become an owner of it.
Thanks for joining us, Ray.
Great to talk to you, Maria.
Ray Suarez is a senior correspondent for the NewsHour on PBS. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Regardless of the outcome this November, for women, this election cycle has proven to be groundbreaking. Senator Hillary Clinton's candidacy brought the debate over equality and sexism back into the national spotlight. And with Alaska Governor Sarah Palin now on the McCain ticket, the debate over the role of women in politics continues. But around the world, women in many countries have surpassed this milestone and are in some cases dominating politics. As part of my documentary for Now on PBS, Women, Power, and Politics, A Rising Tide, I spoke to one woman who is already in the executive office, Chile's President Michelle Bachelet. We bring you now a portion of that interview, an intimate conversation with President Michelle Bachelet.
Is political power the best, most effective way for women to engage power to affect change?
Well, not necessarily. I think leadership can be developed in many different areas. And for example, in Chile, and I don't think it's different in the United States and other countries, you see all over the country in different NGOs or social organizations, women in the head of it. So I would say political power is one way of doing things. But you, because it's the possibility, the opportunity, because you have people has confidence in you, and you have the possibility of developing and implementing your commitment with women. But you can do it in many other places. You can be leaders in, I don't know, in the financial arena, in the social area, in the sport area, wherever, and you can make differences.
But then you get into a position of power,
yes,
the presidency. You're criticized.
Oh, yeah.
You're constantly under scrutiny. You know, people who even say they like you very much say, the president is soft. And what goes on for you when you hear that kind of criticism?
In our societies, of course in Chile, authority is linked to tough guys, you know, who speak very loud, who sometimes they get mad and they scream to everybody. And I thought, do I have to choose a male code of leadership, or can I be myself? So sometimes what people understand as soft, when women are kind, they're soft. And if they are very strong, I won't say a bad word, but of course they are hysterical. And a man like that kind, he's a man of character, you know? So I think there is also some sort of codes, I would say, how people understand what leadership is and what authority is. So why I'm telling you this? People voted for me because I'm always the same. I haven't been acting differently, you know, before when I was Minister of Health and later Defense, and now that I'm a president. And I can make tough decisions.
But is that a woman's issue, or is it simply because that is the way you are?
You know, maybe history will tell what happened and why I came here and all that, because there's so many interpretations. Some people said it's because you are caring people, and people needs on one hand authority, but also needs, you know, somebody to protect them. So some people said, like, you are the big mother of everybody. So,
in fact, I heard one of your close military advisors say the same thing. She's just like a mom. Is that okay with you?
Well, it's a highly reductionist perspective of myself. It's difficult for them to understand that a woman can make tough decisions. But on the other hand, I would say that was more at the beginning. Now everybody's used to it. I mean, I would say it's a matter of time. And probably at the beginning, they were very suspicious. I mean, they never show it, but I thought they were, you know, uncertain what will happen. And it was a wonderful experience. And I have a wonderful relationship with the militaries as a minister and now as a president. And they do understand that I am the commander-in-chief and I have no problem at all. So it is a matter of working together. They see you make decisions. They see you try to understand the best and then make the wisest decision for the country, and they respect you. So I would say it's a matter of time also, Maria, because, you know, you have to change so many role models. You have to change so many perspective, traditional perspective. And I said always, to be a woman is not only, I mean, to be a women president or a women leader, is not only to wear a skirt, you know, it's sometimes also a way of doing politics, a way of doing things differently. And that has been my approach.
So the first time that you had to address soldiers in the country when you were Minister of Defense, I heard that you worked a lot on making sure that you sounded.
Well, I didn't work a lot. I just knew that I could not speak like, you know, a very high-level voice or something like that, because, and of course I learned how to march, to do everything you have to do, and it's very easy because I love to dance and I love music and I have good rhythm, so it was very easy for me. And women usually are very good at that sort of things.
But because you were defense minister and now our commander-in-chief, I mean, ultimately the role of a soldier is to be trained to kill, right? So how do you put those two things together, being a mother, a woman, and at the same time knowing that the role of the military is ultimately to be able to take someone's life?
Well, but it's the same thing as always. For example, I am a person who believes in dialogue and understanding, but there's a minute when you have to make decisions. And of course, with the soldiers, we train them to defend the country, but also they go to peacekeeping operations. So you can open the perspective. But in the sense, as a woman of power, I would tell you, I dialogue, but there's a minute when you have to make decisions. You cannot be dialoguing forever. I mean, people need decisions, and I have make tough decisions, and I will continue doing it. And not only by myself, I call a lot of people so they can give me good suggestions. Because I think to command, it's also to articulate capacities, to produce opinions in favor of what you're doing, and I do that.
An excerpt from my conversation with Chile's President Michelle Bachelet. For more, tune into my documentary on Now on PBS, Women, Power, and Politics, A Rising Tide, airing this week on Now on PBS. For more information, go to latinousa.org. And now, permítame que les cuente algo un poco más personal. When I travel for work around the country and around the world, my iPod creates the soundtrack for my experiences. This past summer, I ended up in two amazing places. First, Chile, on a dream mission to spend 3 days tagging along with President Michelle Bachelet. Chile has been one of those places that I've been fascinated by ever since September 11, 1973. That was the day that I watched the presidential palace in Chile go up in flames on the evening news. Inside La Moneda was the democratically elected socialist president, Salvador Allende. I arrived in Santiago at 6 o'clock in the morning this past July. The snap of cold air let me know that I had arrived indeed in El Sur, where the summer means winter. I got to my hotel room and had 2 hours to get ready before setting off to meet La Presi, the nickname people have for President Michelle Bachelet. I plugged my iPod into some speakers, and the soundtrack of my summer continued with the sound of composer and musician Michael Ramos and Charanga Cakewalk from their CD Lotería de la Cumbia. To me, this music has a no-borders kind of sound, which is why this CD, along with my requisite Bob Marley, accompanied me in Chile as I made my way from Santiago and the Andes to Valparaíso and Viña del Mar on the coast overlooking the vast Pacific Ocean. This was the furthest south I had ever been. I was enthralled by this country, by the energy on the streets of cosmopolitan Santiago, and by a presidenta who is creating a legacy of leading not like a man, but like a woman. My journey over the summer continued as I left Chile and a week later started on a 2-day plane trip to the other side of the world, to a country that is now the leader of women in power and politics, the unexpected country of Rwanda. Rwanda has more women in government, percentage-wise, than any other country in the world. The women leaders of Rwanda govern with the same principle as Michelle Bachelet. It isn't just about being a woman in power or being able to own your own power. No, these women measure their power, again, by how their policies will change the lives of women and girls in a very real way, for the better. In Rwanda, you can't help but be affected by the horror of the genocide that left 1 million people dead. But women now make up almost half the parliament. And women politicians here are all about collaboration, all about looking forward with hope, though never forgetting that it was sadness and horror that did propel them into the role of political leaders. Their sadness, though, is like the music of Michael Ramos and Charanga Cakewalk. It's a sadness that has a rhythm that moves you forward, not back. Throughout all of my travels, I run. I run to feel the actual power of my own body. I run to be inspired by the others I see running alongside me. I run because that is also when I cry. And that is when I clear my head and allow myself to feel happy and optimistic, which is urgent in my life. So thank you, Michael Ramos and Charanga Cakewalk, for being the soundtrack of my summer of 2008, the summer of Chile and Rwanda and women in power, women who are the rising tide of change. You can find out more information about the stories you're hearing by visiting us online. Our web address is latinousa.org. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us.
Uno, dos, uno, uno, dos, dos, tres, cuatro.
Yeah.
You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The inauguration of Michelle Bachelet as Chile's first woman president also coincided with the inauguration of neighboring Bolivia's first indigenous president, Evo Morales. Juan Morales has a strong approval rating among the country's indigenous majority. His socialist policies are being violently opposed by business leaders and landowners. Reese Ehrlich reports now from Santa Cruz in eastern Bolivia.
The sun shines brightly as political leaders with brightly colored ceremonial sashes gather in the Santa Cruz Central Plaza. The National Police Band plays a martial tune, but some of their instruments are missing valves, and they can't seem to hit the right notes. Since the early 2000s, Bolivia has faced one discordant note after another. Workers, peasant farmers, and indigenous people held massive demonstrations and road blockades to protest economic policies favored by the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. Then, in 2005, Bolivians elected leftist Evo Morales as president. And since his inauguration, Morales has faced fierce opposition from the country's economic elite. Carlos Dirios, vice president of the country's Oil and Gas Business Association here in Santa Cruz, says the wealthy didn't recognize how serious the problems had become.
We live in a failed state. And this failed state, it's not Evo Morales' fault. You have to recognize that. It is the fault of the elite that run this country. And what I'm saying is not very popular with my fellow elite, but it is the truth.
As the first president of indigenous origin in Bolivia's history, President Morales's policies have been popular with the poor. People of indigenous origin make up 60% of Bolivia's population, and a majority of them live below the poverty line. President Morales was reconfirmed in a mid-August referendum with 67% of the vote. Central to Morales' success is the spike in world prices for oil, natural gas, copper, and other minerals. President Morales forced foreign energy companies to renegotiate their contracts and pay higher taxes. His government used the revenues to create a new pension fund, distribute scholarships to students, and improve the country's medical care. But business and political leaders here in the eastern part of the country say Bolivia is on its way to becoming another Venezuela, resource-rich and run by a quasi-dictatorship. Eduardo Paz is president of CAINCO, a major business association.
What we have is a central government today, influenced by Chavez, influenced by Venezuela, that wants to stay in power perhaps 30, 40, 50 years, and that's not democratic from our point of view.
Jerjes Justiniano sharply disagrees. He's rector at the Ecological University and a former Socialist Party deputy.
Y de ahí por qué el peligro con el que Estados Unidos considera a Evo Morales. Y de ahí por qué la tenebrosa campaña de que Evo Morales va a ser un segundo Cuba, que Evo Morales va a ser el segundo Chávez.
The U.S. considers Morales as very dangerous, and it has invented a campaign to say Morales will make Bolivia a second Cuba, a second Venezuela. Morales represents the rising of oppressed and indigenous people throughout Latin America. Calling Morales another Chavez is a way to ignore the important social movements in our country.
During one performance, the off-key National Police Band was joined by musicians from the Army and Navy. Together, they played the country's national anthem, in tempo and on key. Perhaps if various political factions in Bolivia learn to play together, they will hit the right notes. For Latino USA, I'm Reese Ehrlich, Santa Cruz, Bolivia.
The election of Evo Morales as the first Bolivian president of Aymara descent has given hope to other politically marginalized groups, not only in Bolivia, but throughout the Americas. One such community, Afro-Bolivians, have long struggled for basic rights. They're among the poorest and most overlooked in the nation. But as Yasmin Khan reports, Afro-Bolivians are reaffirming their cultural roots and finding a place for themselves.
Afro-Bolivians are now recognized in the country's new constitution as one of Bolivia's 36 official ethnic groups. However, they are not recognized as indigenous, such as the Aymara, Quechua, and Guarani people. Jorge Medina, director of the Afro-Bolivian Center for Community and Development in La Paz, says it is a victory to be recognized in the Constitution, but that there is a lot more work to be done.
Los niños mueren por diarrea, en su mayoría, y porque no alcanza el dinero para llevar, vuelve a la pobreza. Todo está relacionado con la pobreza.
The fundamental problem in our communities is poverty. We lack education, health services, basic services, and infrastructure. We have health posts and schools, but no teachers. It's like having a luxury car, but no money for gas or tires. It doesn't make sense.
Un auto de lujo, pero no tengo plata para gasolina ni tengo llantas, entonces prefiero no tenerlo, ¿no? Eso es lo que pasa en las comunidades.
Compared to Brazil and Colombia, both of which have very large populations of African descendants, the ancestors of Afro-Bolivians were brought to Bolivia over a short period of time. Because there were no new African slaves brought in, many of their traditions, including language and religion, faded away in just a few generations. Many Afro-Bolivians adopted the religion, language, and traditions of the indigenous Aymara peoples, such as the Panchamama goddess and growing coca. Afro-Bolivians celebrated the election of Evo Morales, the country's first indigenous president and former coca grower. Juan Miguel, an African-American New Yorker who moved to Tacaña 6 years ago, says he believes Morales will help the impoverished coca-growing Aymara communities and in turn will help the Afro-Bolivians who live in and around those villages.
He knows, he understands the suffering. He used to be a coca farmer. Okay. Now he's president. And we here are coca farmers also.
Afro-Bolivians say one sign that their culture is becoming more widely recognized is the spread of the Saya lyrics and beat to Bolivian rock music. And along with fighting to be part of the new constitution, Jorge Medina has decided to spread the culture and values of Afro-Bolivians through another popular musical genre, hip-hop. Although many Afro-Bolivians say that it's up to society to change, some are hopeful that being included in the new constitution can bring changes to their communities, including recognition, understanding, and eventually more tangible changes such as healthcare and education. For Latino USA, I'm Yasmin Khan in La Paz, Bolivia.
Estamos con la raza, yo. Andamos con la raza, yo.
And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. We had help this week from Jorge Olivares and Engel Entertainment. The documentary, Women, Power, and Politics, A Rising Tide, for now on PBS, was produced by Mary Alice Smith with Allison Shigo and Adrian Heisman. Our listener comment line is 800-533-5533, and our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the Center for Mexican American Studies, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring. Catalog at 1-800-FLOORING. This is NPR, National Public Radio.